This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is The Breakfast Grill, the world's most powerful superpower, but also the country that has had more than 600,000 deaths from COVID-19. The land which prides itself as a champion of democracy and freedom of speech, but also faces challenging race relations and a divided nation. And a country which just celebrated its 245 years of independence on the 4th of July. This can only be the United States of America. And today we welcome its new ambassador to Malaysia, His Excellency Brian McVitus. Now, selamat pulang, as we would say, because this is not the first time representing your country. The last was during 2009 and 2011 when you were the political counsellor. So let's start with the current state Malaysia is in and your observations of it compared to when you were here last. At that time, Dato' Sri Najib was the Prime Minister. UMNO was a dominant party in government. But fast forward, today it's a very different picture. What do you make of the current situation and some would say unstable government?
Well, terima kasih. Thank you for this opportunity. You know, I guess I would start from the point of view of U.S.-Malaysia, you know, rather than trying to evaluate Malaysia per se. So in terms of U.S. relations with Malaysia, things are stronger and more developed than they were 10 years ago. In 2014, we both agreed to a comprehensive partnership, which you might say is just a buzzword. But as a result of that, for one example, we have three times as much security cooperation in monetary terms and also in terms of people-to-people contact on the military side than we did before. So U.S.-Malaysia continues to advance. Malaysia itself, I've only been here a few months this time, but Malaysia continues to advance. In my view, having lived in other parts of Southeast Asia, Malaysia is, a relatively high-tech place, and that's become even more so. Prosperous middle class. I think the middle class has grown, and consequently, we have more markets for U.S. products. So things keep moving ahead. You know, we're all under the COVID shadow in the United States as well as here in Malaysia. But if you look aside from COVID, I think Malaysia had steady growth, steady, impressive growth for 10 years since 2011. And that shows, a bigger, more advanced economy, a more more interesting skyline in KL and more traffic. I guess there's a downside too.
Well, recently less traffic because all of us are under some form of a lockdown. But I just want to go back a little bit to politics. And on some level, you're right. We have made strides forward, but it seems that we've also made some strides backwards. One of which is, of course, now we are in this state of emergency. And there's some concern, I guess, among analysts as to why it's being imposed, although it's a health one. Does that concern you or does it concern American interests in Malaysia?
I think there's interest in having a stable partner, and Malaysia has been a stable partner. Some of the businesses that we work with are concerned about uncertainty, in terms of maybe not so much in terms of politics, but they're concerned about the uncertainty that comes from COVID, MCOs, EMCOs, changes. In terms of politics, I think we leave that. We're reading on a daily basis like everybody else, but we leave that to the Malaysians to decide for themselves. The state of emergency is, we understand it's a temporary situation for Malaysia and we kind of wait for the Malaysians to make a decision about what's next.
Now, have you communicated these views to our government? Have you had a chance to meet our Prime Minister and key members of his cabinet, albeit it's a changing cabinet as we speak?
I met then Deputy Prime Minister Muhyiddin when he was in 2011. I haven't met him this time yet, but I did have a chance when I first arrived in March and April and May before the lockdown. I had a large number of meetings. The foreign minister, the home affairs minister, I've met twice. The defense minister, chief of defense forces, the finance minister, minister of communications, I met virtually yesterday. So I have good relations with a number of ministers, including Khairi Jamaluddin and Minister Hishamuddin, who were both at the airport on July 5th to receive our vaccine donation.
So let's talk about this new Malaysia-US relationship. We have to admit, President Joe Biden is a very different leader if we compare him to President Donald Trump. So finally, can we say goodbye to the mantra, America first, and how does that change our relationship?
The mantra, I guess probably the mantra maybe is not the place to focus. In some ways, every American diplomat, including under this administration, is America first in terms of, our job is advance U.S. interests so that they benefit American people and American workers. And that, if you look at President Biden's speeches and Secretary of State Blinken's speeches, they emphasize that. So, the base, and I think it's probably, if you talk to a Malaysian diplomat, they're out there to advance, Malaysia first in one way or another. There is a change in the sense that this administration is more interested in multilateralism, reestablishing, some relations with partners that have been neglected in past years. And so we're emphasizing that and working with the UN much more than we were in the past few years.
But there's also this perception, right, of a bit of a trust deficit after 4 years of a very inward-looking foreign policy. So I'm curious, how can we rebuild these long-term partnerships?
I think we do it, here at the embassy, we have a number of bilateral programs, and I could go into as much detail as you want to, but basically, in the three main areas of security assistance that I already mentioned, or security cooperation, already mentioned, we have a lot of people-to-people ties, including, encouraging young Malaysians to go study in the United States. And we have a lot of economic and trade ties, and I know we'll talk about that. But I guess what I'm saying is, when you read the headlines about lack of trust, that's kind of maybe too vague for me to deal with. All I can say is, we have a lot of very engaged programs here at the embassy. We have about 100 Americans that are working on them, day in and day out. And we have a lot of smart Malaysians working with us too. So, we're building all of our lines of partnership with Malaysia every day.
I would suppose then the gift of the 1 million Pfizer vaccines earlier this week to Malaysia is just the start of this growing bilateral relation. Can we take it as a big sigh of relief that then U.S. also sees the importance of equitable access to vaccine? Of course, the mantra, this one I think we all accept, no one is safe till all of us are safe.
Right. I mean, I think the U.S., the U.S. has had a traumatic experience with COVID, and we sympathize with Malaysia going through the same thing, maybe on a different time scale. But I think it's important to note that the United States has been active all along. The 1 million donation to Malaysia on Monday was a highlight for us here at the embassy. But the United States is the biggest supporter to COVAX, $2 billion contribution. And that translates into 100 million vaccine doses have been provided by COVAX. Now, Malaysia is also supportive of COVAX and receives some vaccines through COVAX. So more generally, the United States, continues to be the world's largest public health supporter, everything from AIDS to preventing the next pandemic. We've had this leadership for a long time, and we continue it.
But there was a period where that wasn't the case, right? I mean, especially in the early days of COVID-19, in the first quarter of last year, there was a lot of vaccine nationalism and hoarding of essential equipment, even by the United States. So I suppose those days are over?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just quibble with your premise a little bit. I mean, it seemed that way, and I saw the same news stories that you're referring to. But my point is, even during that time, the United States was making contributions to COVAX, continuing this world, kind of world baseline public health effort. For example, for years in Malaysia, before anybody even knew the word COVID, we had a program that was basically, how do you detect and prevent the next pandemic? Like studying zoonotic, viruses that can transfer to animals, to humans, studying those viruses, in the rainforest. So, I don't think we ever got away from that. Unfortunately, there was a perception that, that there was, kind of vaccine, all the vaccines being kept in the United States, but that's certainly no longer the case.
So going forward, can we expect that perhaps there might be, and I think this is something President Joe Biden alluded to earlier, where America is perhaps more open towards sharing the intellectual property rights of the vaccines?
The United States has made clear in conversations with the WTO that we do favor in this case, in the case of COVID vaccines, dropping some of the intellectual property requirements to allow, development of further vaccines, manufacturing of further vaccines around the world. That's a departure from normal U.S. practice. So it is, you're right in making that statement.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is His Excellency Brian McFeeters, U.S. Ambassador to Malaysia. When we come back, the elephant in the room, China, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to the Breakfast Grill. In the hot seat this morning is His Excellency Brian McFeeters, U.S. Ambassador to Malaysia. Just a moment ago, we were asking his views on the political state Malaysia is in. Now, I would like to move to ASEAN. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, there has been no ASEAN ambassador from the United States since 2019, which I don't know whether it's indicative of the previous importance the US government placed in the region. So I'm just curious, what is now the ASEAN foreign policy strategy?
ASEAN remains very important. The United States has had, relations with ASEAN for 45 years. We were the first country to place an ambassador in Jakarta, I think that was in 2008. So we have a long track record. The issue of placing an ambassador there now is, just a matter of the new administration getting going and filling positions. I'm sure that will happen. But both on the kind of political side and the economic side, the U.S. sees ASEAN as very important. We joined the East Asian Summit in 2011. You'd have to go year by year, but in most years, the president has, made attendance of that, which is not easy when you look at a presidential schedule. On the economic side, I think many people would be surprised to learn that the United States has more investment in ASEAN. I think it's like something like $350 billion than it does in China, Korea, and Japan combined. So we have a huge economic presence, and many of the companies in Malaysia see Malaysia as not only important, but ASEAN is important.
Do you see Malaysia as the gateway to ASEAN, though?
In many ways. I mean, I think we have, frankly, we have American companies active all over ASEAN, but Malaysia is certainly one of the gateways, especially kind of in the area of electronics, increasingly things like cloud computing, in line with Malaysia's digital agenda, U.S. companies are there. And then also, increasingly in the healthcare area, I've heard Malaysians recently talk about biotechnology. The U.S. is ready, right? I mean, we have the capability in all these areas.
We'll come back to foreign direct investment in a moment, but I want to talk about Myanmar. It has become an issue globally, of course. Now, we can argue that Malaysia and also ASEAN's role in that crisis is probably a lack of one, actually. But how does the U.S. view this situation?
The U.S., I think we join with nations around the world in recognizing that the people of Burma rejected the coup, right? They want to return to democracy, and we see that as critically important. We really see, even though the U.S. has taken a number of actions in relation to Burma, we see the role of ASEAN as critical. We're strong supporters of the five-point agreement that came out. I just had to look it up because it's been a while, April 24th. So that's been a little while. Frankly, there needs to be more progress on that. Mm. On the other hand, we know that, ASEAN is set up so that, things are deliberative, things take time, a lot of things take consensus. But you mentioned Malaysia. Malaysia has been a strong leader. The prime minister and the foreign minister have made very important statements and interventions about the importance of restoring, legitimate government to Burma.
But some would say the issue about using ASEAN to push this issue forward in Myanmar is that not all countries in ASEAN are themselves champions of democracy.
I think it's a mixed picture. I mean, it is challenging. On the other hand, the countries did get together in Jakarta. They, all 10 of them met. They came up with a plan. So I think it's never easy at this level. But I think ASEAN has the capacity to make real progress.
Okay, let's talk about South China Sea. Over the last few years, it's become Malaysia's most strategic but also vulnerable maritime domains. And there has been a sharp increase in multi-stakeholder territorial disputes. And the concern here is that we will be dragged into some major power competition and be collateral damage. Now, so what is the U.S. role in this conflict, though?
The U.S. role is, if you boil it down, it's about trying to uphold a free and open Indo-Pacific. Instead of looking at it as potential, military conflict zone, which everyone wants to avoid, I would suggest you look at it as a vital commercial area. There's something like, I think I keep hearing different numbers, 2 or 3 or 4 trillion worth of global trade goes to the South China Sea every year. So it's, I think all countries share the idea of keeping it free and open. We're concerned about some of the activities of China. You know, some of the, it goes beyond assertiveness, aggressiveness of the, you know, the challenge to countries, the kind of the lack of respect for a fair and balanced playing field. So we're, you know, free and open Indo-Pacific is one summary of what we want. And the other one is preserving the rules-based order.
Would you say the other thing, of course, is to bring stability into the region? But at the same time, you also have overtures recently, like there was a military mission with the U.S. aircraft carrier group led by the USS Ronald Reagan in the South China Sea. Isn't such action run counter to what you say and could perhaps lead to maneuvers that are misinterpreted?
I mean, the transits of U.S. Navy vessels, I mean, they sail all over the world, right? You know, there was no incursion into Malaysian or any other waters when that happened. So that's just a continuous, you know, that's part of the U.S. Navy and, you know, U.S. government's effort to keep the sea lanes open and safe. So there's no, you know, you could take any spot in the world and there would be not only U.S. Navy vessels, but other navies are, you know, transiting all over.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room, China, because President Joe Biden has not signaled a softening in stance towards China. There doesn't seem to be any de-escalation of tension. But yet, over the years, Malaysia's relationship with China has become closer. I mean, even recently, Malaysia's Foreign Minister, Dato' Sri Hishamuddin Hussein, on his first visit to China, called his counterpart Big Brother. Is there any concern here that China's influence in Malaysia is too pervasive?
We don't have a concern about China's influence on Malaysia, because that's up to Malaysia, and we know that there's very strong economic ties and, you know, the infrastructure and all that. That's Malaysia's choice. What we do have concern about is China's, you know, kind of making these excessive and illegitimate maritime claims. You know, you had the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea court rejected China's claims. You know, that's the basically highest international body. I think it's roughly exactly 5 years ago. So we our concern is that China is not obeying international norms. You know, we've said that, you know, because of that, member states have to be prepared to defend their own interests. And we have security assistance to Malaysia that basically gives them that capability.
So you're saying that you're behind supporting countries where they have had incursions in their waters?
Well, we're behind giving countries the capability to know what's happening, right? A lot of it is like, you know, how do you cover a giant ocean? A lot of it is having the capability to see what's out there. We assist with that. And then having the capability to defend their own interests if necessary.
What would you define as having the capability to defend your own interests, though? How far does that go?
Well, that's the way militaries, you know, militaries around the world have national security mission for whatever country they're in. So, you know, I wouldn't speak for the Malaysians, but that, you know, the general approach of the United States is, you know, through programs like the Maritime Security Initiative, which covers not only Malaysia, but the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam, is basically, you know, give these countries capacity, you know, like capacity to know more about the maritime domain, and then capacity to, you know, have like improved equipment, you know, that the militaries can use.
And is the revival of the Quad, which is a quadrilateral security dialogue, a strategic one between US, Japan, Australia, and India, a response to China's increasing dominance in this region then?
No, the Quad is, you know, the Quad came about kind of almost on an ad hoc basis after the 2004 tsunami. I happened to be working on the region at that time. And since then, it's primarily, you know, a group of like-minded democratic countries trying to advance economic interests. So it's not a security partnership. It's you know, it's basically the way one of the speakers that I heard recently said, it's trying to deliver international public goods, like just create cooperation. The tsunami was a perfect example. You know, things like international emergencies.
Let's shift to trade. I mean, the U.S. is our third largest trading partner, with bilateral trade to the tune of close to $60 billion U.S. dollars, with, of course, a surplus in our favor. But I want to know how we can still strengthen this relationship, because if anything, COVID-19 has reminded us how vulnerable and interdependent both countries are to each other.
You know, that's something we're very interested in. We're very proud of the fact that that there's, you know, you mentioned trade and that there's also large investment. I think U.S. investment in Malaysia is about $25 billion. That's second only to Japan. So the two go together. We have leading U.S. companies here, you know, things like Intel, First Solar, Hewlett Packard. They've been here, you know, when I was here 10 years ago, they were already here strongly. And then we have what we have, I think, you know, in answer to your question about how do we go forward, we have a new generation of American companies coming in, you know, in terms of cloud services, Amazon, Microsoft. Microsoft has just announced that they're going to build a data center in Malaysia, and they're going to train, they're going to, what they call skill, 1 million Malaysians, right? So that's not only business, but it's capacity building for people. I think, you know, when you look at Malaysia, that's the digital blueprint. When I read through the digital blueprint, I kept coming across like, oh, these are areas where U.S. can be active. So I think if you look at Malaysia's vision for the future, it matches very well with what the American companies can offer.
But on the flip side, if we are so important from a trade perspective, I'm just curious, why haven't we signed a trade agreement? Is it the American government dragging its feet, or is it the Malaysian government dragging its feet?
You know, the Biden administration has not made any decisions about trade agreements. Our sense is that when they do happen, they'll be probably multilateral rather than bilateral. We don't know that for sure. But one thing we do know is there's a lot of emphasis on any kind of agreement or prospective agreement has to be worker-centric, has to be, you know, frankly, focused on improving the welfare of workers in the United States, right? So we're going to probably take a fresh look at trade agreements.
So you won't be looking at the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership as a solution to this?
We simply don't know yet. The decision on that has not been made in Washington.
Because, on the other hand, China has made strides with the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement. So I guess the question is, what is the commitment from the U.S.?
You know, we have strong trade relationships, not only with Malaysia, but with other countries in the region, ASEAN and beyond. And, you know, we have, in each case, even if we don't have a free trade agreement, we have what we usually call it a trade investment framework agreement, which is kind of a lower level, but important. It's a mechanism for talking about, we're having trouble understanding this particular regulation. Can you help us? We think this set of regulations is discriminatory against U.S. companies versus Malaysian companies, or other foreign companies. Let's work through that. So we continue that, and we think we can make a lot of progress in that area, just sort of taking the issues one by one.
On a special extended breakfast grill this morning, we are speaking to His Excellency Brian McPhetus, U.S. Ambassador to Malaysia. When we come back from the 8:30 a.m. news bulletin, how best can we attract more U.S. FDI? BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to a special extended breakfast grill with His Excellency Brian McPhetus, U.S. Ambassador to Malaysia. Just before the 8:30 a.m. news bulletin, we were talking about the South China Sea and could this be the next war zone? Okay, let's talk about trade, the long-term foreign direct investment, which is critical for an open economy like Malaysia, especially where exports currently are our sweet spot. But what can we do to attract more US FDI? And let's face it, it's a competition against our ASEAN peers, and we do want to benefit from this, what they call substitution effect from the US-China trade war.
As far as attracting more, I mean, we constantly try to talk to the business groups, American Chamber of Commerce, individual businesses, and what we hear from them is, on the one hand, Malaysia is great, large middle class, skilled workforce. English speaking does not hurt a bit for us. That helps us. But they tend to say that they're concerned about the future of their own companies, you know, either reinvesting or new companies coming into Malaysia, because of what they see as a lack of transparency and lack of predictability. So they sometimes see, you know, regulations that pop up that they weren't expecting, that they, you know, didn't have a full explanation of, and then they find, you know, with the implementation, it can be kind of tricky for them. So what we've said, I mentioned earlier meetings with ministers. What I've said on behalf of the companies is if Malaysia could set up some kind of consultative mechanism where, you know, maybe once a quarter, the leading companies, you know, or the company representatives, the business chambers, if they can go in and kind of hear from the government, here's what we're looking at over the next 6 months. What do you think? Give them some time to comment. and then have the companies, you know, raise issues like, you know, they're having trouble. Some companies are willing to invest more, but they have to see some kind of conditions change. So I think it's doable, but the companies would like to have kind of more of a dialogue with the government.
For businesses, how critical is it for them that there is political stability, that there is a rule of law and corporate governance when it comes to deciding whether to invest in Malaysia or to put more money into the country? Do these concerns arise in your conversations with them?
They definitely do. And, you know, companies, like you said earlier, it's a competition. So companies are you know, they're frankly talking about options. They describe, you know, conversations with their headquarters in the United States where, you know, everything is on the table. You know, what's the economic situation? What's the predictability situation? What's the corruption situation? Of course, those are all key issues.
Would you say that the levels have risen over the years in terms of the concern?
Well, I think there's it's a difficult question to answer because on the one hand, the level of U.S. investment has continued to go up, right? And like, you know, like somebody like Microsoft coming in and investing $1 billion, right? That's a vote of confidence. On the other hand, I don't know if I could quantify it, but there are concerns. What strikes me is there are concerns on the part of companies that have been here a long time. So they're not, you know, they're established and they want to stay. But what they say is, you know, probably in some cases, maybe not going to expand because of concerns about the unpredictability of the investment climate. So it's a real concern, something the World Bank has focused on as well.
Now, I read your opinion piece in the New Straits Times this week with interest. It was very COVID-focused. But two things stand out from there. One was that the U.S. funds are being used to assist the refugee communities in Malaysia. Are you concerned about how they're treated in this country by the authorities? Because you specifically highlight them.
Any ambassador, you know, when we're sent out on our mission in Washington, we're told our job is to implement the foreign policy priorities of the U.S. government, and those include human rights, trafficking in persons, equal treatment of different groups. So that's a global concern. Any ambassador would be focused on that. Here in Malaysia, I think we do, you know, we have a particular focus on trafficking in persons, forced labor, refugees. On refugees, Malaysia has done a tremendous service, right? I mean, the Rohingya group in particular, to put it simply, almost has nowhere to go. But Malaysia has always been a place where they can go. Now, it's not perfect, but, you know, many Rohingya are alive and, you know, getting along somehow in Malaysia that wouldn't be able to, you know, without Malaysia's receptive attitude. That said, there's, you know, concerns with, in some cases, there have been an attitude lately of like, well, let's expel these boats and not let them land. So I think we constantly keep a conversation going with the government of Malaysia about, you know, please be good to refugees, allow the UNHCR to process them. They have a whole evaluative mechanism. And then if necessary, the United States, you know, is resuming the program of accepting refugees. And so we'll be stepping up on that.
Now, related to this, of course, is the recent U.S. State Department Trafficking in Persons report, which downgraded Malaysia's ranking to its tier 3, putting us in the same category as Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Syria, Russia, and Venezuela, and there are other names. Not such a good club to join, obviously. Now, I want to know, like, have you had any discussions with the Perikatan government over these findings, and will we be penalized in any way as a result?
The trafficking in persons report is very important. Again, it's global. We have had discussions with the government of Malaysia, not only after the report was issued, but, you know, constantly. We're in kind of a ongoing dialogue with the government of Malaysia about the information. Trafficking in persons comes down to, you know, a few key areas, which is, you know, how do you prevent it? How do you protect the victims? And then how do you prosecute, you know, the people that perpetrated the trafficking? In Malaysia's case, there's a kind of a technicality that Malaysia was on the tier 2 watch list for 3 years in a row. And the legislation, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, has a specific limitation that says you cannot stay on that level for more than 3 years. So we had to make an evaluation with our colleagues in Washington about, you know, has Malaysia done enough to be raised to a higher level, or does it need to be placed on tier 3? The judgment was it needs to be placed on tier 3. because of not enough implementation. Malaysia has excellent plans. They have a five-year plan. They have a new plan that MAPO has put out, but we don't see enough implementation of that. You know, I'm glad you raise it because I think it's one of these things that many, many Malaysians and frankly, many Americans maybe don't think about. But, you know, if a domestic servant is a domestic worker is told that they can't have a day off or they have to have their passport locked up, that's trafficking. You know, I mean, people might think, oh, no, that's not trafficking. That's just my servant. Well, that's trafficking. So I think it'd be helpful if Malaysians, you know, Malaysia is an up and coming upper middle class country. They should be more aware of this issue, you know, and ask questions because it happens. It happens in the United States too. We're not perfect.
Yeah, exactly that, because it does happen in the United States, especially the US and Mexico border. There are lots of people trying to escape gang violence and poverty. So what is being done on your end to avoid it?
Yeah, we have, I mean, there's a trafficking in persons report about the United States as well. You're free to look it up. I think it comes down to law enforcement. I think Malaysia and the U.S. have a similar situation in the sense that you might have an individual who comes into the country illegally. It happens in the United States, including at the Mexico border, and it happens in Malaysia. So that person, is an illegal immigrant and they've broken a law. But then the second thing that might happen to that person is they become trafficked. Like maybe they get, you know, sold into sexual slavery or they get abused somehow. Then that's a trafficking violation that needs to be, you know, dealt with. And so in the United States, we have, you know, a large number of programs where experts try to go and teach local police forces, like how do you recognize a victim and how do you make sure that they have a chance to tell their story?
Finally, what are your priorities as the U.S. ambassador to Malaysia since you start? This is the beginning of a new term for you.
As ambassador, kind of two broad areas when you think of like bilateral programs. I think I mentioned earlier, you know, we have three main headings, people to people, that's education. Let's get more young Malaysians to study in the United States. Second is security. You know, as I said, we have an expanded security relationship with Malaysia. We're providing, unmanned aircraft for helping with looking at South China Sea and upgraded aircraft for the same purpose. So that's the security area. We do a lot of people to people exchanges on the security side. And then the third one we already discussed is trade investment. You know, how can we increase U.S. exports here? We have about $1 billion in agricultural exports to Malaysia. We'd like to, you know, double that if we can, right? Because Malaysia is a large middle class, upper middle class market. So those are the bilateral ones. But also any ambassador has to be aware of global priorities. So the Biden administration has placed a lot of emphasis on climate change. Climate change is central to our foreign policy. And it's a big effort here at the embassy. We want to work with the government of Malaysia on making ambitious climate change plans in advance of the Conference of the Parties meeting in Glasgow in November. Basically, you know, how do we work as the government of Malaysia to raise its ambitions in terms of reducing carbon emissions? We want to work with Malaysia in terms of its positions in the UN. You know, we're returning to multilateralism, trying to work with the international organizations. So, I would like to add here that it's sometimes there's a sense of like, wow, an ambassador has to be, you know, really super talented to do all this. It's not the ambassador, it's the team, right? So we have about 100 very dedicated U.S. Officers here from about 8 different agencies and 200 Malaysians, you know, that are very talented. And that's how we make an impact.
On that note, thank you for your time. Today on The Breakfast Grill was His Excellency Brian McFeeters, U.S. Ambassador to Malaysia. I'm Wong Shaoning, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.